question of what happens after we die has intrigued humans for as long as we've been around.
As a physician, I know that most people don't think about death really until they're forced to.
Her brain was not functioning, and yet she had the most vivid experience.
My near-death experience changes how I understand death.
We think these people, they're gone, but they're always watching after us.
Someone said, "What is your name?" This thing is talking to us.
The first story that Ryan ever told, he said, "Mom, I think I used to be somebody else."
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. This is the biggest claim ever.
I don't believe we know everything.
Their loved one from the other side is there helping them cross over.
These signs and messages are always around us.
I would say, send me a cardinal when you get to heaven.
I can't explain it, but I know it was him.
If this is real, people should know. It'd change everything.
I think I'll be asking questions till the day I die. Again.
Leslie, it's a pleasure to have you back on the channel. Last time you were here, we were covering the fantastic reporting done by yourself and Ralph Blumenthal for the New York Times regarding the UAP issue. But this time, it's a conversation about human consciousness and whether or not it survives the physical death of the body. Do we continue on after the physical experience? Now, you did your own investigation, and this investigation culminated into a book called Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for an Afterlife, which has since been adapted into a Netflix series. And we're going to get into all of this and more. And hopefully, in comparison to our last interview, it is going to be a little bit less of an interrogation and more of a conversation. But it's great to have you back on.
Thanks, Jay. It's great to be back on with you.
Now, obviously, as an investigator of this issue, you've remained as objective as possible, presenting an unbiased assessment of the incidents that you have studied and discovered during this journey of yours. But the book isn't necessarily just an outsider looking in and trying to decide whether or not there is some truth to this. I mean, on this journey, you have also had experiences that would appear to have had a profound impact on you. And so before we dive into some of the specifics of this book, can you just tell us how this journey that resulted in the writing of this book, how this has changed your viewpoint on life and death?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very big question. It has dramatically changed my position on it, because when I started researching the book, I really hadn't known that much about all this stuff. I mean, when I wrote my UFO book in 2010, the difference was I'd spent 10 years investigating it, right, and I kind of pulled everything together into this book. But this book, Surviving Death, the writing and the researching for that book became a journey unto itself. I mean, I had no idea what was going to happen to me during that journey. I thought it was just going to be sort of research into these different areas. But as you said, it turned out that I had a whole lot of experiences that kind of went along with it.
Right,
and
right.
We can talk more about them. But, you know, the combination of personal experience and research, there's nothing like it. And, you know, it's really the personal experience that it has the most personal impact and really changes you. But I also feel like the research is really, really powerful too. So I, you know, I didn't expect any of this, and it really opened me up to the possibility that I certainly feel convinced that consciousness functions independently of the brain. I just think there's a lot of evidence for that. Whether that also happens when we die and therefore it just continues on, there's evidence that's highly suggestive of that. I don't think we can prove it though. But it's very intriguing evidence that that could be the case. And that's sort of where I landed at the end of my book. I kind of landed at feeling that it's highly likely and there's tremendous intriguing evidence, but proof is something we don't have.
So was it the UAP, UFO, UAP issue that was actually the initial subject that you got involved in, and then this came afterwards?
Exactly, yeah, because I started reporting on UFOs in 2000, actually. So it's been about 20 years now. Yeah, and so after my book came out in 2010, there was I did a series on it I did a special with the History Channel about it, and then, you know, some other things that followed, but then my publisher just asked if I wanted to do another book. And this was the topic that I knew I wanted to do because I had been exploring this topic over the years, sort of in the background, particularly the cases of children with past life memories. I'd also been present at the death of my friend Bud Hopkins in 2011. And that really had a profound impact on me because I'd never been with somebody before at the moment of death. And it just was very provocative for me. So it was something I'd been interested in a long time. And when this opportunity came up to do another book, it was something I just wanted to jump right into. And that's what happened.
Well, I would highly encourage anyone who hasn't done so yet to read your book. We will be covering some specific cases and events in the book. But if you wanted to get the full picture of this investigation that Leslie has undertaken, then you can't go wrong with reading the material in full. So links will be in the description box below. So you can go ahead and check this out when you're done listening here. Nevertheless, we will give you a good idea for what the investigatory efforts of Leslie entails. And with that being said, something you highlight early on in the book are the concepts of psi phenomena, telepathy, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, precognition. Now, these are all expressions of what we could essentially call elements of expanded consciousness. When did you first become interested in the concepts and potential applications of expanded consciousness? Was it during your journey on this book or was it actually prior to that?
It was really prior to that, Jay, because I was always interested in it. I mean, I would say way back, you know, and all during the time I was reporting on UFOs, it was sort of in the background for me.
Right.
And I was particularly interested in, you know, not so those things which I consider to be human capacities, but I was also interested in to what extent are those capacities related to the possible survival past death? I mean, that's the crucial question that I was exploring in this book, because there's a lot that human beings can do with those capacities that have nothing to do with the question of survival. They have a lot to do with the question of what is consciousness, but not so much about survival past bodily death. So I had to stay very focused in my book on that question because there's so many fascinating paths you can go down just exploring things like precognition or clairvoyance or telepathy. But I had to stay directly focused on the question of surviving death. And that's where the focus was.
Yeah. Well, a little segue just away from the book for a moment, just for me personally, one of the primary areas of study that I was involved in when I first dipped my toes into the UFO issue was actually remote viewing. And I spent many hours trawling through the CIA's online Freedom of Information Act library. And I came across, you know, the Project Stargate and the collaboration between SRI and the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences and things like that. I'd love to get your thoughts on just real quick, the US government's decades-long remote viewing program initiatives. Do you think there's actionability to the concept of remote viewing?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've read a lot about that. I've talked to some of the key players in that field. I know Hal Putoff very well, who was one of the original investigators. There's no question that it's a real capacity and that the US government's been interested in it, no doubt.
Yeah. Now, in your book, you quote British psychologist David Fontana, who studied the evidence for psychic abilities for over 30 years. And he was quoted in your book to say the following: psychic abilities are a matter of fact, not of belief. What they are and what they mean for our view of reality is another matter, but one cannot dismiss them as fiction and yet retain credibility as an unbiased observer. Now, I would agree with this statement, and since it's included in your book, I can only assume that you resonate to some degree with Dr. Fontana's position on this, but it feels to me like there is a level of cognitive dissonance at work here. I mean, we have these special buildings all over the world, in every country, where people can go and essentially talk to a deity that they believe exists, many of which we communicate with through what we call prayer in one way or another, which in of itself is pretty much an attempt at psychically communicating with what we call God. But what I find very interesting about this is that this type of communication through prayer is only really acceptable as long as there isn't a direct response back from what we call God. If there is a visible exhibition, a tangible response of some sort, that's when it seems to become very controversial, which is really quite bizarre to me, because it almost seems as if people don't feel comfortable with a direct response occurring from something like a prayer. And if someone claims to have seen an angel or spoken to God and then God spoke back, that's when people don't really like to hear about it. And it seems like there is quite an abstract line in the sand when it comes to acceptable levels of spirituality or mystery, and especially with what we might call psychic abilities. So my question is, why do you think such a large percentage of the world is willing to believe in some form of a god? But the concept of psychic abilities, non-local coherence, the ability for consciousness to interact independently of the human body, why is this still so controversial when it would seem to be symbiotic with how people believe they communicate with a spiritual force through a religious paradigm? Why do you think psychic abilities are not given the same level of appreciation?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, first of all, you mentioned about the responses that they might get through prayer or meditation or something are not really taken seriously. And I think the thought there would be, well, how do we know that person isn't just creating their own responses? I mean, they're not necessarily objective. I think the interesting thing about psychic abilities are that they have an objective component to them. They can be studied, they can be documented. And I think, you know, there's a threat that they carry. The paradigm, which is based on, you know, that we're just physical matter and that when we die, that we're done, you know, we're just a brain. That perspective does not allow for these things to be true. And it threatens what people understand about the nature of consciousness. So I think it can be sort of seen that religion is kind of it's faith-based, it's thoughts, it's human mythology, it's all the things that, you know, it's a faith, whereas these other components, if you're studying them, they're actually can be on the edge of science. You can document them, they're real. So, you know, when something's real, that challenges the current paradigm, that's a big deal. And I don't think anybody would say religion does that. It's just in another universe from something that you can document that's telepathic, for instance. So I think I've had many encounters with those kinds of phenomena, those kinds of realities, those experiences of telepathy and clairvoyance and all these different things. So I know they're real and I can document them. And I don't think that the skeptics want to hear about that. They're not going to allow for that. But a lot of them probably go to church.
That's my point. It's weird.
I mean, it makes sense to me because they're two different realms of thought. You know, they're two different ways of interacting with the world. And I think even a lot of religious people don't like to honor aspects of consciousness that don't fit within their belief system, even if they have a belief system that includes God.
Right, right.
Like there's a lot of Catholics, for instance, who think mediumship is satanic. You know, mediumship, even if it helps people grieve, even if it's documented that mediums can bring in information that's accurate, you know, so it's just a mess of belief systems out there. But what I'm really interested in, what I try to bring forward in the book, is there is solid evidence for the reality of these things. Just like David Fontana said, the fact that these capacities exist is a fact. What we don't know is, you know, whether this means we survive death, but we certainly know that humans have these extraordinary capacities. We don't know necessarily what the force is that produces them, where they come from in some situations, but we know they exist. And as far as I'm concerned, there is, like David Fontana said, and Dean Radin has said the same thing, and others, there's absolutely no question that they exist. So that's documentable. And it's a threat to the physicalists, you know, the people that don't want to allow for this kind of perspective on consciousness being something more than just neurons in the brain generating something, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like sometimes you need some sort of, not every time, but you need some sort of catalyst. You know, like many people, myself included, have experienced what is sometimes classified as like a form of awakening. You know, I wouldn't even pretend for a moment to say that that means I've got the answers. That's not what that means to me, but I feel like I've woken up to certain things that I believe to be real. And many people, again, myself included, experience what's classified as an awakening off of the back of a depression. And I've spoken with a lot of people about this, and there does seem to be a level of agreement that major depressions or big impacts in one's life can precipitate some form of spiritual awakening within oneself. My own personal journey is full of synchronistic moments, but all my understandings and newfound beliefs stem from an impactful and, in my case, depressive situation. Do you think major depressive events or impactful events can precipitate what some would call a spiritual awakening?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not my area of expertise, Jay, but I do know that like trauma, you know, and loss and traumatic events can certainly open up the mind in a certain way. You know, but I'm really no expert on knowing whether depression can lead to these kinds of awakenings. That's just not.
No, me neither. Just from a personal point of view and from some people I've spoken to, it seems like there can be catalysts like that. But getting back to your book, there are many different cases, some of which are near-death experiences. But one that I would like to unpack a little here was categorized as an actual death experience. And this was the experience of Pam Reynolds, classically trained songwriter and orchestrator, mother of three, who lived in Atlanta. She was diagnosed with an aneurysm that was deeply embedded into her brainstem. Now, in order for the surgery that was required to be successful, Pam was put under what is known as hypothermic cardiac arrest. This process involves quite literally the draining of a person's blood from their body and the ceasing of all brain function. So during this process, there is absolutely no brain activity that we can detect via instrumentation. Could you, for everyone listening, can you explain what happened to Pam once she was, momentarily clinically dead?
Yeah, I mean, and it actually was about a 30-minute period. And not only was the blood drained from her, but the other important point is that her body was cooled down to about 60 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 60 degrees centigrade. So her body temperature was lowered dramatically. And then the blood was literally drained from her body. She had the aneurysm was at the base of her skull. So they had to remove part of her skull to kind of get underneath her brain. It was a very, very, very risky procedure. She didn't think she would survive it, but you know, it was the only option she had to live through this. So anyway, so during this time where they were working on her, she also had her eyes had were taped shut. She had tape over her eyes and she had these devices in her ears that made a lot of noise. They were as loud as a lawnmower, actually. And they were in there because they were helping the doctors monitor the brains in some way. But so she had no hearing or no sight. And the bottom line is that she left her body at a time when the doctor, Dr. Robert Spetzler, who is a famous world-renowned neurosurgeon who had developed this technique of hypothermic cardiac arrest, you know, he was just an outstandingly well-known physician. And he testified that there's absolutely no brain activity. That brain is gone. There's no way that anyone can even think or have perception or see or hear anything in that state. So Pam described going out of her body and she had what's classically called a near-death experience. But I think what's more important than that part of it is what she was able to report back. So she went into the room out of her body and she was able to hear what people were saying in the room. She was able to see what kinds of tools were used, hear the sound that the actual pitch, because she was a musician of this, the sound of this device that they were using to excavate her brain and report back what they said. And she was also saw them defibrillating her heart before she came back into her body. And so this is evidence that she was really out of her body. She was looking at things also from a certain perspective in the room. And the doctor had absolutely no explanation for how this could be possible. And she was able to report back, you know, what she heard and saw, and it was exactly accurate. So, you know, that's just like the fact that she could have consciousness in that condition is just beyond the comprehension of anyone, but it happened. And so that when you talk about the actual death thing, this is really about there's a doctor named Sam Parnia who studies, he's an expert in resuscitation science. And he sort of believes, and he's a really interesting guy if people want to look him up. The notion of a near death experience, he just feels that it should be called an actual death experience because he has witnessed cases in which it has to do with the body temperature being lowered. There are some cases where when the body temperature is lowered, like if somebody falls into a frozen lake or something like that, they can actually be dead for hours and then come back. And as far as he's concerned, when they're dead for hours, they're dead. There is no difference between the corpse of that person who's been dead for 3 or 4 hours than there is with the person who's not going to come back.
Right.
So, yeah. So if somebody comes back after 4 or 5 hours, he's, as far as Parnia is concerned, this is real death. He says it's an actual death experience. And he says that death is a process. It's not just a moment. So that the concept of a near-death experience, he just feels is a little awkward because you can't really measure what's near death and what isn't death. So it's a sort of a sense of terminology. But he, you know, so that's sort of when I wrote about Pam Reynolds, I actually sort of transitioned into his concept of that she was, I mean, you couldn't say she was actually dead. They were keeping her alive with a machine, but her brain was absolutely zero functioning of that brain during this experience. And that's really phenomenal. And there are many cases like this. Hers is just a particularly strong one.
Yeah.
But there are so many people who have had these experiences of leaving their bodies when they have no brain or heart. They're basically dead. And then being able to report back. And then, and the idea is that it's not just what they hear and see in the room, but they go on these journeys. That's what the near-death experiences are. And they will go into what they perceive as an afterlife realm and often meet with beings there, and they don't want to come back, and it's beautiful. And they talk about how they can move around through thought and all these fascinating things. And what's interesting is that the experiences have a lot of things in common, a lot of elements that are similar from people who have them all over the world. And there are doctors, medical doctors and scientists who have studied them. And so they're really well documented.
Did she actually, other than being conscious of the operating room, did she experience an afterlife type thing, or was she just experiencing that room from multiple, almost omnipresent angles?
She did. She actually was first in the room and saw all this stuff and heard this stuff. And then she felt, she said she saw this point of light, and she felt herself pulled towards that point of light. And she did go into this other realm. She saw her uncle who had died. She saw her grandmother. She talked to them. She didn't want to go back. So she did. She had what we call a near-death experience.
Right.
As well as having this experience of being, you know, out of her body and being able to see what was going on while they were operating on her.
Well, this is quite interesting to me, this very physical sensation of being pulled, like a feeling of inertia, because I must admit, although not through a literal near-death experience, at least not in this current body, I've also experienced on two occasions this exact feeling from deaths that I've gone through in dreams. Have you ever experienced what you would consider to be a very real feeling of dying whilst in a dream?
I never have, no.
Can I tell you this story real quick?
Yeah.
So there's actually two occasions that this happened to me, and both of them involve being shot. So if they're real lives, then I've gone through some pretty nasty stuff. But the first time I had this dream, the first time this happened, I was actually a soldier in the D-Day landings. I was definitely on the Allied side of it because I was storming the beaches with a bunch of people. This was the most linear, real dream I've ever had in my life. There was no abstractness to it whatsoever. I was literally storming the beaches. I was in military uniform. I was running up. I was shooting at Germans and storming the bunkers on the beach. And this dream, now there are certain bits where it kind of cut and I can't remember, it skipped ahead, but I went from the beaches to being in a convoy in the back of a Jeep with a bunch of other soldiers. And then I ended up on patrol in the forest, and I was in this forest on my own by the looks of it, walking. I had an M1 Garand in my hand. I could see I had the holding a rifle, and I was walking through this forest, and it's funny because I almost felt like I was an observer. I didn't necessarily feel like I was experiencing it, but I was definitely looking through that person's eyes. I just kind of almost felt like I was observing. And I felt this impact, and it was a bullet. I heard this whiz, like a whistle through the forest of something flying towards me. And I felt this impact, and it hit me directly in the center of my chest bone, and I fell onto the ground. And I put my hands over my chest and started applying pressure to my chest. And I was lying down in the middle of this forest, and I could feel warm blood going through my fingers. Like, literally everything about this was so real. And I was looking up at the tree canopy, and I was just breathing. I was just taking these long breaths and trying to keep myself calm. And literally my breath started echoing and like echoing in my head. Everything started getting very drowsy. My eyesight closed in. So like tunnel vision, it started, like the tree canopy in my peripheral started getting very blurry, and then everything kind of got dark around the edges, and it creeped in until I could barely see anything. And then it went dark, and there was a momentary pause of it being dark, and then I just had this huge sense of inertia. Like I was just being pulled down a dark tunnel. It was completely, I don't even know if it was a tunnel, it was just dark, but I was just getting pulled. I could feel this incredible sense of inertia, and then I woke up.
Well, I'm glad you didn't die.
Yeah, tell me about it. I had this experience one more time when I was I was running through an allotment. I don't know if you have allotments. Did you have allotments in America?
I don't think I know what you mean by
that. Okay, well, an allotment is like a plot of land that people share and they all have greenhouses and they grow vegetables together. It's like a community garden, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I was running through an allotment and I ran into a greenhouse. And I know these are dreams, but it's just so bizarre to me. I was running from something. I ran into a greenhouse and I was hiding underneath the shelving inside this greenhouse, and I saw someone slide the door open. They had leather gloves on. They were holding a suppressed pistol, and they held it up to my head. And I knew I was going to die. And I just literally, I remember in this dream going, "Just do it, just do it, just do it." And I turned my head away, and I knew that this was it. And they shot me, and they shot me in the head, and I instantaneously got flown out of my body. So the same feeling I had in the forest when I slowly seemed to pass away happened extremely quickly. The moment I was apparently killed, I just felt like I was being catapulted down this dark, you know, like it was completely pitch black. But this feeling of inertia I've experienced twice in dreams, and I know that they're dreams, but it just, the fact that people have described it makes me wonder if they really were dreams, you know?
Yeah, maybe they were memories of something.
Yeah, so maybe I need to have some regression therapy.
If you want to. That doesn't sound like it were fun experiences to live through, though. Yeah, so maybe no. You don't want
Yeah, maybe not, actually.
More of them than you've already had.
Maybe you're right there. But to get back to the story at hand, something that fascinates me profoundly is the way that Pam explained how communication worked when she was outside of her body and interacting with her deceased loved ones, because she explained it as an instantaneous communication through thought, that any thought was instantly sent out and received. And this chimes very closely with the concept we have, and I'll apply a physics paradigm to this. It chimes closely with the concept of quantum entanglement as it relates to non-local consciousness and the capacity for essentially quantum information to be exchanged between separate systems, separate people, instantaneously, regardless of distance within space and time. Now, my own personal belief is that consciousness is the substrate upon which the entire physical framework of the universe arises from. And so consciousness or thought is able to subvert what we believe to be the rules of time and space, because consciousness is responsible for creating time and space, in my opinion. And so if you yourself are utilizing what we could call an expanded level of consciousness, then you quite literally are able to bypass the linear time-space construct that we exist within right now and instead interact directly with essentially the spectra of thought, the energy of consciousness. So I just wanted to see if that idea resonated with you at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how people would describe kind of what happens when they have these near-death experiences. I mean, here, I can read you, actually, because the chapter, I have this whole transcript in my book of Pam Reynolds' own words. This was taken from an interview that she did some years ago. And the way she describes, I think, what you were talking about, she says the quality of communication was much better than we have here, because there it moves with the speed of light. It's rather like being on the other end of a pulsing laser. All you have to do is think. All you have to do is think it, and the thought process is sent out. There's no misunderstanding in what gets said. What gets said is the truth. Maybe that's sort of what you're talking about.
That's the part that I read where I was like, oh, well, that's, you know, instantaneous exchange of thought. And so,
exactly.
Yeah.
She's describing it, you know, it's very simple language. She wasn't interested in any of this stuff. She's just,
no, yeah.
A whole section of my book that's actually all in her own words. She just narrates in a very kind of down-to-earth, simple way. This is what happened. And, you know, her descriptions are very razor clear and simple. You know, she's not embellishing anything. And I love that description that I just read. And she also said that the people she interacted with in this other realm, she says the people were wearing light. They seemed to be made of light.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, the ones I recognize, it's as if there had never been a separation between us. Anyway, you know, it's just these great little images that she has. And again, they're so universal from people who have had journeys that are similar to hers.
Something that's always fascinated me are the cases all over the world of children, and it's not just children, but it does seem to be more common with young children. And these memories, then tend to fade with time about past lives, which I have my own ideas about. But this idea of past lives, and there are so many cases of young children who are convinced that they had a past life, a different family, grew up in a different geographical location, and sometimes even within a completely different time than the one they currently occupy in their new body. And you include in your book an extraordinary case involving a young boy named, and I might pronounce his second name incorrectly here, James Leininger?
Actually, Leininger.
Leininger, right. So could you just take us through this case? What exactly was James experiencing here?
Sure. And it depends how much time you want me to go into it, because I probably will not give all of it because it would just take too long and people can read it. I actually opened the book with this case because it is so incredible.
Right. Yeah. No, just an overview of what was happening.
Yeah. I mean, and just to comment on what you just said, I agree that these cases are common, but what's not common is where the child provides enough specific information that you can actually find out who that previous person, we call it the personality, who that person actually was, and identify that person and find out if the memories are accurate. In order to do that, you've got to have a significant amount of specific memories. So that's what's unusual. And, the University of Virginia Medical School, the division of perceptual studies there, where they've done all these studies of these cases. So anyway, the case of James Leininger, he was born in 1998, and when he was around two, he just started to have all these memories. I mean, rather than go to each specific one, I'm just not going to, but the bottom line was that he had memories of being a World War, of crashing. First of all, it was just about crashing in an airplane.
Yeah.
He had a lot of knowledge about airplanes, first of all, and fascination and obsession with planes. And, one of the first experiences was his dad took him to a flight museum when he was just two, and he was just freaking out at seeing these World War II planes, and he didn't want to leave, and he was screaming. And then he started to have these nightmares of reliving some kind of experience where he was in absolute terror. And he would say, "Airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out," over and over again. And they would happen, five times a week. And his parents took him to the doctor. They didn't know what was going on. And eventually he just started to talk more. And he told them who the little man was. He said, "The little man is me." And he gave the name of his best friend, Jack Larson. He talked about what kind of plane he was flying. He said that the flame, where the plane was hit, and that it burst into flames and it crashed in the water. And, it flew off of something called the Natoma. Because his dad, his parents would occasionally ask him when he'd bring something up.
Yeah.
They didn't touch it, but he would. "So where did your airplane fly off of?" And he said, "The Natoma." And this was, again, a little kid who'd been exposed to none of this. He said he flew a plane called a Corsair. He seemed to know how the details of these different aircraft from World War II. It was just uncanny. One time he was looking at a book with his dad, and he pointed at a map of, it was about World War II, because his dad got out some books about World War II, which is what parents often do when their kids have these obsessions. And he pointed to an area near Iwo Jima, and he said, "That's where my plane went down, Daddy." And so with all this information, his father did all this research. I mean, it was a period of years. His father was determined to prove that this was not a past life memory, right? Which is so interesting, because it contradicted his religious beliefs. We were talking earlier about religion.
Right,
here's an example. And he just, his mom was more open to it. So, there were a lot of things that happened where he was able to, he found information. He went to veterans meetings. He called up people he found out that there was a boat called the Natoma Bay. And eventually he found out, this was an aircraft carrier in World War II, that there was one pilot who had died flying off that aircraft carrier, and his name was James Houston Jr. And what was fascinating was that little James had drawn a number, hundreds of drawings, but there were a number of them he signed. There were drawings he would draw obsessively of this plane crashing into the water.
Yeah.
Bullets flying all around and smoke and flames and everything. He would sign his drawings James 3. And this was before they knew anything about James Houston. And his parents would say to him, "Why are you signing it James 3? And he said, "Because I'm the third James." And they didn't know what he was talking about. He would just say, "I'm the third James." So when they found out about James Houston, it was James Houston Jr., which would have made him the third James in his mind. I mean, there was just such, you know, there were so many things like that. They actually were able to find Jack Larson, who was a name that little James had provided as being somebody who flew right near him and was his best friend in World War II. The guy was still alive. They were able to find him. They were able to find the sister of James Houston Jr. So there was a whole dynamic.
Did he meet James? Did he go out and meet the veteran?
He did.
Yeah.
James, there's a photograph of James in my book with Jack Larson. He also met Annie, I forget her last name, but Annie, the sister of the person he was in his previous life, James Houston. And she became convinced that indeed he was the reincarnation of her brother because he knew all this stuff about their childhood, even that nobody else knew. So, you know, it's a very, very strong, and this case was, you know, it was basically James's dad, Bruce, who did all the work to discover who James Houston was and was able to verify everything that his son told him. But what was important about it was that all of it was on the record before they found Houston.
Right.
It's a really important element of having a solid case if in terms of being evidential is that, you know, everything that he printed out on the computer about the Natoma was dated. There are videos of James talking about this stuff. They made notes. All these, this record existed so that nobody can say, oh, after they find Houston, they change their story. You know, it's all, all there in the record. And then, you know, Jim Tucker from the Department of Perceptual Studies, Division of Perceptual Studies it's called, got involved with this case after it was solved. By solved, we mean that they found who the previous person was and kind of verified everything. But, and the dad was able to integrate this reality into his religious framework, which was a beautiful. So I invited Bruce, the dad, to send me little statements and essays about his experiences, which I incorporated into the chapter. So I find it really interesting to see his evolution and how this impacted him. It's really a big deal for the parents who go through these things, way more than it is for the child.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
And the child needs to have a resolution to all of this, which James Leininger had when he was 8 years old. They went back to the location of where his plane actually went down.
Which was beautiful. I remember seeing that in the series. Yeah. He was very emotional.
That's right. And they did this ritual where they said goodbye to James Leininger and all the people who died. And he just sobbed and sobbed. And
then he was fine, right?
And then he was fine and he just moved on in his life. Yeah. A lot of children, they just need, they just something
closure.
Like that happened. Yeah.
Yeah, some so level that was, of closure.
That was the moment. And we went back in the series, if people want to watch that, in the last episode of the series, we deal with this reincarnation case. And we went back and talked to James when he was 21 years old.
Yeah.
About, you know, maybe a year ago or something. So that was a really fascinating thing to experience was see what he was like and how this has affected his life and does he still remember it. And if people want to know more about that, they can watch the episode 6 of Surviving Death on Netflix.
Well, yeah, it's such an extraordinary tale, that one, you know. And I remember when I was reading it, I was transfixed, and when I was watching it, I was absolutely transfixed. And you know, it's funny, I remember first hearing about past lives, especially past life memories in children, from a documentary in high school that was shown to us by our religious studies teacher. She was awesome and was easily one of my favorite teachers. She was a practicing Buddhist, and this documentary she showed us highlighted specific cases in India. Now, what fascinates me about this, especially in relation to specifically India, is that within their culture, they recognize reincarnation as being part of, you know, part of reality. And it kind of makes me think that it may be the case that high levels of past life memory are coming from places like India, because reincarnation is recognized as a part of their cultural and spiritual fabric. It would seem sensible to me, at least, that, you know, as a culture, if you recognize the reality of this type of thing, that it would be more likely that that culture would then experience higher levels of remembrance in regards to past lives. Do you think that the cultural and spiritual fabric of a society or country or group of peoples can directly impact an individual's ability to remember something like a past life?
I think it's more about, not so much about whether they remember it, but about whether they talk about it and take it seriously. I mean, that's the difference.
Right.
As you say, you know, if the culture accepts this as part of their reality and their belief system, then when a child has these memories, the parents might ask them more about it or and you know, they kind of nurture it and it's accepted. Whereas in America, the parent will say, "Oh, you're fantasizing. You just had a nightmare." You know, it doesn't really mean anything, and they're just not curious. So I think a lot of it is that more than it is that there are more memories there. I just think, you know,
more about dismissal.
Yeah, whether they're discussed, whether they're encouraged, whether they're nurtured by the parents. And, you know, Ian Stevenson, who was the father of this whole body of research, absolutely wonderful investigator from the University of Virginia, he documented many, many cases in India and Sri Lanka and Burma and all these countries in which it is accepted. That's where he went first.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's so great about the James Langer case and the second one in my book, which is Ryan Hammond's case, is that they are American, because there aren't that many in America that we know of where we can actually find who the previous person was, where there's enough information to do that. And I think it's because the culture just doesn't include that as part of, you know, its reality. So it doesn't, the cases don't come to light.
Part three in your book as well is titled Communication from Non-Local Minds, with the chapter being titled My First Personal Experiment. And this is in regards to your own investigations into the concept of mediumship and communication with those that have passed on. Now, you were quite thorough in vetting the mediums that you visited. Can you talk about your experience with the medium called Laura Lynn Jackson and how these experiences have impacted you in your own personal life?
Yeah, I mean, Laura Lynn Jackson is an outstanding mental medium who lives in Long Island, New York, and she's been working for decades as a medium. I mean, I don't know, Jay, do you want me to explain what mental mediumship is, or do you think people know?
I think maybe quickly unpack that for people.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I don't know, a lot of people think of mediums as like crystal balls along the street and
some shop,
you know, or something like that, and that's not... When you're a really good medium, that has nothing to do with it. And she's a woman who had these gifts from childhood, basically. And eventually, just, it's a long story how she developed them, but she has this ability to sit with somebody. And the person having the reading is called a sitter. And she's the medium. And she sort of acts as a telephone operator for the sitter. So you will go to her as a sitter wanting to connect with somebody who's died. Basically, people will go when they're grieving and they want to connect with their loved one. And Laura is sort of serving as like an operator. She can connect to the other side and bring through information to the sitter. And a lot of what happens is the first step is to bring enough information through that the sitter becomes convinced that actually is the person they knew. And unless you bring through specific information, the sitter has no way of knowing that. So once that happens, there's, you know, it's a stunning experience to have. And in my book, I write about my own reading with Laura, where I was fairly skeptical. I didn't know what was going to happen when I was able to set up this reading. And I did it because if I'm going to study mediumship and write about it, the best way to do that is to have your own readings, is to start going to mediums and see what it's all about, and setting them up in situations where she couldn't have known anything about you in advance. And this was done on the telephone. She couldn't even see me. It was all done on the phone. And it was just absolutely phenomenal how much specific information came through for me from two loved ones, not only information, but also personalities. I mean, that was just striking. And, you know, I made lists of all the points she gave me, and I was able to calculate what percentages were accurate. And it just had a very big effect on me, Jay, because I didn't know this kind of thing was possible. And you really do feel in that environment, you feel like your loved one is there. I mean, I allowed myself to enter into that state of mind.
Yeah.
I just want to have that experience. And I knew that I was taping it, and therefore I could do the analysis later. And I think, you know, the bottom line question that comes up with mediums who can do this and who are accurate, and who, you know, there aren't that many, you know, they're really consistently accurate like this. The question is, they feel that they are getting information from the spirit, from the other side, from the deceased person. And you could also argue that perhaps they're getting the information through their own personal psychic abilities, like we were talking about earlier, which would mean their own clairvoyance, their own telepathy. They're reading the minds of the sitter. They're, you know, pulling the information somehow from the world that we live in, as opposed to getting it from a dead person. And that's sort of a debate that's ongoing within the community of people who study this question There's no way to prove that the medium is getting it from a deceased person, but lots of times they'll bring through information that the sitter doesn't know. The sitter only finds out weeks later when they go speak to their grandmother, you know, that the grandmother, their grandfather had some quality or had some piece of paper with a name on it or some specific detail that the medium brought through that the sitter didn't know about. So it's a big, big, it's a universe of research. There's also been investigators who have studied mediums and tested them under very rigorous conditions and have found out that indeed they do consistently produce this information that they can't possibly know. So that's one example of what we were talking about, of consciousness, a demonstration of consciousness being something beyond the physical brain, that somehow these people are able to access this information through ways that we don't understand. As far as they're concerned, they're speaking to your deceased loved one. Yeah. And it's an amazing thing to have an experience of that. I had it with a second medium as well, and which I write about in my book. And the same two people came through, and there it was just... It was life-changing for me.
Well, one thing that when I was reading through it that made me smile was when Bud Hopkins came through and was essentially saying, Leslie, you were right. You were right.
That was an amazing moment, Jay.
I can imagine.
I have to tell the story. It was like, because nobody will know what you're talking about. But when he first came through Laura Lynn Jackson, it was Bud Hopkins, who's a well-known UFO investigator. He was the man, he was the person I mentioned earlier that I was with when he actually died. And he was in hospice. And the last few weeks when he was in hospice, or maybe the last month of his life, I brought him over all these books about the afterlife. And I said, look, it may not be the end. You know, you can check these books out. One of them was a book about Ian Stevenson. Another one was a David Fontana book. And he was a curious intellectual, Bud. He loved to read.
Yeah.
And he cared a lot about what I was thinking about. But he, for some reason, he would not read these books. And he said, I already know it's not the way it is. Death is, you know, death is the end. And I kept saying, well, why don't you just read these? It might make you feel better, you know, or whatever. He just wouldn't go there. So the first thing he said when he came through with Laura Lynn Jackson was, you were right, with great excitement. You were right. And I knew exactly what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And then Laura, the medium, you know, she paused for a moment. She said, I don't know what that, she said, this has something to do with you were right about the afterlife.
Yeah.
That's what mediums do. They bring through this information that just shocks you that they would ever know it. And what was extraordinary, just to finish this little story about mediums, and then we'll move on, was the second reading I had with a medium named Sandra O'Hara, which was a few months later. I asked Bud Hopkins and my brother, who was another person, but to come through with the second medium, Sandra. And I said, I want you, this is just to tell, you know, I just sent up this message like into the universe. I want you to repeat something that you said to Laura so that I'll really know it's you. And I wasn't thinking of anything specific. I just said, repeat something or bring through some information that you brought through with Laura, also with Sandra, so that I'll know it's really you. And exactly the same thing happened with Sandra. He said again, you were right, you were right. And he said it twice, both times. So it's just, wow. It's just stunning. You know, when you get something repeated like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It rarely happens like that. It was just an exceptional, in that moment in time, I was had this exceptional experience with these two mediums. All the energies were there for that to happen, and it happened.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
No, it was a really beautiful moment in the book. And I just remember smiling about it. It was a feel good moment for me. And, you know, moving on, I want to talk about an individual that you mentioned in your book, a Nobel Prize winner in literature, Mr. Thomas Mann, one of the most influential German writers of the 20th century and a self-described skeptic who ended up having his own experiences within seances. And these actually involved the materialization of apparitions. Now, you yourself have had experiences with similar events during seances, and we're going to get into that next. But can you talk about your decision to include Mr. Thomas Mann's testimony from his own seance experiences? What struck you the most about his accounts in particular?
What I loved about Thomas Mann, and I'm so glad you asked about it, because it's sort of this nugget buried in my book that nobody ever mentions. It's one of my
right?
favorite
yeah.
parts of the whole book. It would be Jay that would be the one to notice it, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Because he's just such a brilliant, brilliant writer. I mean, he was one of the most influential German writers of the whole 20th century. He was And so what's amazing about it is the way he describes his experience. And I could totally relate to it because I had a similar impact when I went to a physical medium. And again, this is physical mediumship, which is very different from mental mediumship, which I was talking about before. In physical mediumship, physical things happen in the room that you can see that are impossible things, like objects levitating and things moving around the room and stuff like that. And so, you know, he went to have a sitting with this young medium named Willie Schneider about, you know, and again, as you said, he was a skeptic and he wrote about that. He wrote a long essay about these experiences, and it was at the home of a famous investigator who was a physician, and there was psychiatrists there and scientists and all these intellectual people, and it was thoroughly controlled. So, you know, I don't want to take a lot of time of how they control it, but they make sure that there is nothing phony going on, no hoaxing or anything like that going on right. with this medium. And he's, you know, he's held by his hands and feet are held throughout the seance, and all these things are done to make sure that everything is legit. And so, you know, man witnessed things there that changed his life. And I don't know. I mean, what's important about it is the way he describes it. I could read something from it. You know, he first describes, it's just the language, Jay. I mean, didn't you appreciate that?
I really did. Yeah. So if you wanted to read an excerpt, then I think people would appreciate it.
It's just so old fashioned. It's the kind of beautiful language
yeah.
he uses anymore, you know?
Absolutely.
And the first thing he sees was, you know, what happens in physical mediumship is the medium goes into a trance state where he's basically unconscious. He leaves his body, he goes somewhere, and a spirit communicator enters into his body and speaks through his body and uses his body to make things happen in the room. And so this spirit had come into the body of Willie Schneider and first he witnessed a handkerchief that came up from the ground. He saw this handkerchief rise up a few times. You know, and there was enough light in the room that he could actually see. There was a low red light in the room. He could actually see everything. And there were illuminated bands attached to the handkerchief. And, you know, it was easy to see it. And so this was the first thing he saw, this handkerchief going up and down into the air. And he could see this sort of claw-like structure inside of it. And it just completely blew his mind, because the way he described it was, he said, never before had I seen the impossible happening despite its own impossibility. After describing what it was like to see this handkerchief move around the room, he described that it even made him feel kind of sick. You know, he described feeling seasick. It was so shocking to him. He was full of wonder and horror and disgust and sickness, and he didn't, you know, it was just a total shock to his sense of reality, because he's witnessing something that's impossible. And later I don't know what parts to read, but there's one part, I don't know what part to read. I'll probably read his little thing at the end. It's sort of short. He witnesses the spirit can move things around the room. Then the typewriter scenario, he sees this typewriter being played on, being typed by nobody in the room. He just sees the keys moving. So, you know, I could relate so much to what he was feeling, because I also have sat in a physical seance and I witnessed a lot of the same things. For instance, he described this bell being rung by this claw-like materialized hand, basically. And the bell goes up in the sky and is shaking violently. And this is something I've actually experienced myself. So it was so exciting for me to read through this and read his reactions. And then the typewriter, he witnesses that. And here's his comment at the very end. He says, after having witnessed all these physical phenomena that happened in the room, and he did see this apparition also for a brief moment. He says, I am in the intriguing and confounded state of mind in which reason commands us to recognize what reason, on the other hand, would reject as impossible. The nature of the phenomena I have described makes it inevitable that the idea of deception should afterward haunt the minds even of those who saw with their own eyes, only to be laid over and over by the evidence of the senses, by the reflection that deception was definitely impossible. And then he went, you know, it's just like, this isn't supposed to happen, but you have to accept that it's real.
It's so beautifully worded as well. I love the way he says that.
Yeah, here's two more lines I'll read. He said he couldn't resist going back, even though this whole thing made him feel kind of ill.
Right.
He said he wanted to see it again. So this is the way he describes that. For the sight has got into my blood somehow. I cannot forget it. I should like once more to crane my neck and with the nerves of my digestive apparatus all on edge with the fantasticality of it, once more, just once, see the impossible come to pass. And so he did. He went back. And anyway, I love it because this is how I open up, I think, my section in the book about physical mediumship. This guy was an intellectual, a skeptic. Yeah. He's not making this up. There were people in the room that witnessed the same thing, and everybody could verify what happened. And I know this is real. And in the early 1920s, there were a number of physical mediums who could do this. There are fewer of them today that I know of, but there is one I do know of who's genuine. And I've had the experience of spending about 5 or 6 years sitting with him and researching his mediumship. And of course, it's been interrupted by the virus now for a year.
Right. Yeah.
But I witnessed the same things that man witnessed and other people witnessed it with not only with the medium I'm working with, but with other mediums. I mean, these things actually do happen and they're just shocking.
Well, this is what I wanted to get into next, because you've also had experiences in seance environments wherein, you know, materialization of apparitions has been achieved. And understandably, this type of thing is, you know, a little controversial to a lot of people, but you are a very intelligent person. I don't think anyone can really deny that at all. And your experience took place under the direction of a very well-respected medium called Stuart Alexander. So for those that aren't aware of his background as a physical medium, could you just give us a little backstory on Stuart Alexander and explain why you decided to work specifically with him in this field of mediumship and seances, physical mediumship?
Yeah, I mean, what's great about Stuart Alexander is he's been doing this for, I'd say, almost 50 years now. I mean, he's now in his 70s.
Wow.
And he started this journey when he was in his 20s. He had never intended to become a physical medium, but he was absolutely fascinated by physical mediumship. So he just formed a little sitting group with family and neighbors and friends. And over a period of years, he just experimented sitting with different groups. And over a period of years, it just evolved that suddenly something happened to him. And things started happening to him when he was in these environments that showed that he was actually a medium. But he wasn't looking to become one. And then he just went on this very long journey, developing his mediumship, sitting religiously every week with groups. By religiously, I don't mean religion, but, you know, devotedly.
Yeah, yeah.
Week after week after week. And that's how you develop physical mediumship. You sit with the same group year after year after year. He was not interested in publicity or making money. He had a full-time career. He had kids and a wife. You know, this was just something he did for the love of it. And he developed extraordinary abilities and many people have experienced them. And so by the time I discovered him through reading his book called An Extraordinary Journey, it's a memoir that he wrote about his experience as a medium. And I highly recommend this book to anybody interested in this. He actually reissued the book, redid it and kind of updated it, edited it, added new material, and actually invited me to write an epilogue for his book, which came out about, I don't know, 6 months ago or something. And I was very honored to do that. In the epilogue, I described my own journey with him. But anyway, so I had discovered the previous edition of his book and I just reached out to him and he was very hesitant about whether he would even allow me to write about his mediumship in my book. I mean, let alone contribute in any way. And I went to a seminar that he gave and I got to know him and he invited me to come and sit with the home circle, which is what they called it, the group that he meets privately with every week to sit. And that's where I had these experiences that I do write about in my book. I write about the first two seances that I attended and just kept at it. And I made sure that, you know, I inspected the room and all the things you need to do your due diligence with a situation like this to make sure that everything is above board. I mean, I had no questions, really very many questions going in because he had been doing this for so long. And he had sat with all kinds of, you know, investigators and people observing. Yeah. You know, if he was faking it, it would be known by now. That's the point. But I made sure I did all the things that you have to do to make sure about that. And I've gotten to know him very well, and I've had many amazing experiences sitting in his circle. So that this has probably been the most life-changing part for me of all the things that I delved into in my book. And it there's so many, it's such a mystery to me how these things can happen.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of different things that happened that you would like, you know, that we could talk about. But I remember not that long ago, actually, someone sent me a link. It was actually David Haith, a good researcher that I've spoken with quite a few times. And he sent me a link to, I can't remember who you did the interview with, but you were speaking about, and correct me if this wasn't with Stuart Alexander, but I'm assuming it was, you had experiences involving a 19th century Scottish physician, Dr. Franklin Barnett.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even really think of him as that. I think of him as Dr. Barnett. It's actually
Bonnet. Sorry, yeah, Bonnet.
Yeah, and so just like I mentioned with Willie Schneider, with Thomas Mann, how there was a spirit that, or a communicator, whatever you want to call it, who comes into his body. It's the same thing with Stuart. He goes into a trance, and then he has various communicators that work through him. One of five is Dr. Barnett. And Dr. Barnett, what's interesting about him is whenever he comes through, he doesn't use, most of the spirit communicators, and this is all probably sounds so weird to people, but most of the spirit communicators.
Not to my audience.
Speak through Stuart's body. And you can get a lot more detail about this if you read his book or you read my book. But they come into his body and they use his vocal cords to speak. But what's amazing about Dr. Barnett is when he speaks, it's called independent voice. He speaks from a different part of the room. He's not using Stuart's vocal cords. So you hear his voice.
Oh, wow.
Just speaking out of the air. And what he's doing is he's using a substance called ectoplasm, which is this sort of strange substance that's emitted by the medium, which I'm assuming was at play with Willie Schneider, although we don't know because the lights were on and normally you would see it. So I don't know what was going on with Willie Schneider. But with Stuart, there's definitely ectoplasm. So Dr. Barnett is able to make some kind of a device with the ectoplasm so that he can speak through it directly. And it has a very different quality when you hear it from when you hear the others who speak through Stuart. So in any case, the other point about Dr. Barnett is that sometimes he's able to actually materialize himself. Right. So he doesn't just speak through the ectoplasm. He uses the ectoplasm to actually materialize in physical form and walk around the room and touch people. And I know this is beyond people's comprehension. I don't blame you. But this is just, you know, it doesn't happen that often. It's a really big deal when something like that happens. But I probably experienced it maybe 3 or 4 times with Stuart, where I've experienced Dr. Barnett come out. And one of the more recent times, it's just so phenomenal, Jay, because you can hear, there's a cabinet, there's a cloth chamber that Stuart will go into only when Dr. Barnett's going to materialize, because it affects the ability of him to manifest this materialization. He has to be in this enclosed cloth space. You can hear and see the curtains of the door opening. Now the room is dark, so you can't see Dr. Barnett walking around, but you can hear his feet and he'll come and stand right in front of you and talk. So, you know, there's a voice right in front of your face talking to you. And Stuart is in another part of the room because he wears illuminated tabs on his body, just like Willie Schneider did, so that you know he's always there in his face. And Dr. Barnett, actually, the last time there were these hands. He put his hands on top of my head. And he just, I'm doing it right now. You know, he tapped up and down with the palms of his hands on the top of my head just many, many times, really fast. These large human hands that were, and he said, I just wanted to let you know that I forget what he said.
Solid human being? Was it something like that?
Yeah, something like that. I just want to let you know I'm a solid human being. And you just can't.
That's incredible.
You can't describe what it's like. And then then he goes back into this cabinet space, this cloth little thing that Stuart's sitting in, and he just disappears. But it's physical. It's physical. And other people in the room sometimes he'll touch them too. You know, he'll walk around the room. We should start with the simpler things. You know, the simpler things are what Willie Schneider was doing, like things levitating around the room and bells being rung and things like that. And, you know, even those things are amazing, but they're sort of like the lower level stuff that happens in the seance room. You know, all kinds of miraculous. It is like, it's like he said, like man said, you're witnessing the impossible, but it's real. It happens.
You know, I mean, this kind of goes back to what we were saying before we got on record about, you know, how you're able to get this type of evidence. But a lot of people will want to know, why haven't we been able to capture this on film? Is there any sort of equipment that we can utilize to capture this sort of thing? Because I know it's in a low light environment, and I believe that there's an extreme light sensitivity to ectoplasm, correct?
Yes, and there is an event that happens repeatedly in Stewart's seance room, which is done in the light, which is the materialization of a human hand over a table that has red light, which I've witnessed many times, and I've touched the hand. And I have asked him, could we film this? And Stewart just doesn't want it to be filmed. And he, you know, I would just want to mention to people that he actually wrote the last chapter of my book. I invited him to do that. He describes in that chapter why he doesn't want this hand filmed. He also describes it more in his memoir called An Extraordinary Journey. So, you know, it's better if you hear it from him. I understand him well enough. It's mainly because he's afraid that it will create such a big deal that it will be like this huge media event if it's ever made public. It would create such a stir and so much controversy, and all these people would say it was faked, and then they'd want more, and then people
would
want.
He doesn't want to deal with that kind of impact.
He doesn't want that disruption. Yeah. All he wants to do is to keep developing his mediumship, which is always developing. New things are always happening, and sit with his group every week and keep doing what he's doing. And he just doesn't want to deal with the hoopla that would be involved with, you know, with filming this. I still wish I could film it, because there are cameras that can work in that kind of low light. It would have to be a camera that didn't, you know, give off any light of his own, but the technology of it is there. He just doesn't want it to happen.
Right.
And I know him so well. He doesn't like publicity. He doesn't want to be in the spotlight. You know, he would not participate in our Surviving Death series because he didn't want the exposure from that, you know, millions of viewers would have to his face and his work on this Netflix series. I mean, he's just not the kind of guy that's looking to bring this out into the world and say, here, I've got proof, you know?
Right, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, you can read what he says about it, but...
Yeah, for everyone listening, I will put a link into the description box below for his book as well. So if you want to check that book out, that'll be in the description box.
Yeah, I mean, as a journalist, that was one of my initial desires more than anything, was to be able to document that. And then I thought, well, maybe we could just document it. We won't release it till after you're gone, Stewart.
Yeah.
He still wouldn't do it. He just feels like all the skeptics would be all over it, and it might tarnish his legacy, because they would just, you know, he's very sensitive to skeptics, you know, these debunkers who are uninformed saying all these negative things about him. He's very sensitive to that, and he doesn't want to invite that. That's the other thing.
No, from my own dealings with skeptical people, I can understand why he would want to avoid that sort of nonsense, to be honest. But you know, I want to segue real quick into the recently created Netflix series, which is based off of your initial investigatory work on the book. Now, the series is also called Surviving Death, and it takes the viewer on a journey through a variety of different testimonies and experiences from people all around the world. You know, people have gone through near-death experiences, children who were convinced they had a previous life before this one, and much more. Now, as is usually the case with adaptations, the book tends to have more detail than the media production, but this series really has become quite popular. Most of my family have watched it and really, really enjoyed it. And there are some pretty astonishing cases. Let's just talk about the first episode of Surviving Death, the experiences of Mary Neal, who's an orthopedic spine surgeon. She suffered a kayaking accident and was clinically dead. And she'd been without oxygen for, I believe it was 30 minutes that she'd been without oxygen. And when they finally managed to recover her body, it was bloated and purple. Her eyes were fixed. She was very much dead. Can you talk about this experience? What did she go through?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really amazing near-death experience case. And she was under the water for 30 minutes. She basically drowned.
It's insane.
And I think it may have to do with what we were talking earlier about lowering the body temperature. I didn't ask, I actually didn't meet her because I wasn't involved with that part of the shoot of the series, but it may be that that water was very, very cold and that's what allowed her to survive. But yeah, as you said, they'd given up finding her and they just happened to, somebody happened to bump into her in the water when they were trying to retrieve a life jacket of hers that was floating by. And she was this corpse. And she should not have survived. And then they, the other strange thing that there was an, they were out in the middle of nowhere. And so they were, they took her up this, her body on this, down this dirt road. And there was an ambulance sitting there. I mean, that is, I want to talk to her and ask her, like, did she ever ask the ambulance driver how he got, I mean, this is,
why are they there?
Why was it there in the middle of nowhere? You know, and so they, and she went to the hospital. She had all kinds of broken bones and, you know, all kinds of serious physical problems. And the doctor said that she would definitely be brain damaged. The chances of not having brain damage were like zero.
Yeah.
And eventually she healed and came back to complete normalcy, which is amazing. But while she was dead, she had a near-death experience. Where she went to this other realm, sort of similar to Pam Reynolds, but every experience has its own characteristics. And she, it was absolutely glorious, beautiful. She said she felt no pain. She was not afraid because she remembers leaving her body and the whole thing. Went into the light and she talked to beings there. And there's something that happened there, which is, I don't know if we should talk about, you know, she was told something about one of her kids, which I guess I don't want to talk about because if people haven't seen it, I want them to.
Yeah, we'll leave that for people to check out. Yeah.
But she did have a remarkable near-death experience, and she's convinced now that she that death is not the end. I mean, she went there.
Yeah.
And it's just remarkable because not only should she have died under the water for 30 minutes, but she should have had brain damage and all kinds of horrible things that have happened to her afterwards.
And none of these things happened.
For months and months, you know. None of these things happen, and she's just beautifully radiant, lucid, you know, wonderful, brilliant person. How the whole series opens up with her case.
It's a great case, and I like you just said about the life jacket popping up and traveling downstream, which caused one of the kayakers to swim after it, because he thought her husband might want it as basically like a token of her memory. And I have to admit, it was this act of following, right? So the act of following the life jacket that caused the kayaker to come across her body as he was swimming after the life jacket. Now,
like, bumped into her body, into the water.
And it just makes me think, like, too many times in one's life, strange things happen, you know, that we brush aside as coincidental. And I've started to come to the conclusion that there are no coincidences at all, really. They're just, from my personal perspective, simply dependent on your intuitive ability to recognize a sign for what it is. And the same can be said for what happened once they recovered her body as well. Like you said, took her up the main road where an ambulance suddenly turned up out of nowhere in the middle of the Chilean countryside. I mean, at what point do we acknowledge a coincidence is so much more than a coincidence?
I agree with you. It's just, you know, you just cannot, it just can't all be chance that he happened to bump into her arm at that moment under the water.
No.
I mean, a lot of skeptics will argue that it was, but the ambulance thing is the really bizarre.
Yeah, that's the real kicker right there.
I do want to find out more about how that all happened sometime.
I know. I'd love to hear it from the ambulance driver. Like, why were you there in the first place? You know,
I wonder if they ever asked. I mean, she was completely unconscious and they were just focused on getting her.
Obviously, yeah.
So they probably never even asked. I don't know. Maybe didn't even speak the language of
the
driver. I don't know.
It's extraordinary.
It's a beautiful story. And I think what's great about the series is it's about characters. It's about people and they come to life, you know, and you go on all these journeys with these characters. Whereas my book is way more sort of focused on the details of a case and the evidence. I feel like it's very readable. And, you know, these people come to life in my book too, but it's more a kind of, as I said, detailed and focused on evidence for survival, whereas the series is more focused on the journeys of people who are asking questions and kind of dealing with experiences they've had that they didn't necessarily ask to have. And people who are going to mediums and people who are grieving and people who are having visions at the end of life, you know, what does that mean? It's sort of asking, what do all these things mean without really giving an answer? But it's a different journey. It's a different experience than reading the book. I think they're complementary, good complements for each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to skip over right to the other side of this with the final episode, which covers reincarnation and specifically an extraordinary case with a young boy aged 5 called Atlas Aubrey. His mother, or current mother, based on the nature of this story, tells us about how when they were driving in the car one night, Atlas suddenly began describing a previous life, saying that he missed his mum, and he told his current mum that when he was this other child, he was murdered. Would you be able to just quickly tell the listeners about this young boy?
Yeah, it was just phenomenal. He was about 5, as you said, and he said, and his mother said, he said, "I miss my mommy with the curly hair who used to take me to the playground." And his mom said, "Oh, you mean me when I take you to the playground?" And he said, "No, my other mom." And so she said, "Well, who's your other mom?" And he said, "Her name was Washington and my name was Jalen Robinson." And then he later said to her, "When I was that boy, Jalen Robinson, somebody killed me." And so she went on the computer and looked up these things, and she found, our news stories about a little boy named Jalen Robinson, who he was African-American. He had been murdered by a nanny or something like that. And his mom was named Robinson, just like little Atlas had said. Everything matched up. It just gives you chills because he had never been exposed to any of these things. He wasn't on the computer. He wasn't reading, that's another case in which the child was specific enough that you could actually find, who that previous person actually existed. I think that child was only a few years ago before Atlas was born that the previous child died.
So. Yeah, one thing that actually kind of struck me with this case was the mother talking about the struggles she had in trying to understand this, and going on to say that within the very religious confines of her own family, they didn't want to discuss this with her. And it actually kind of harkens back to something we were talking about before, because they actually attributed potentially Atlas's past life memories to demonic work. Now, I don't want to offend anyone, but quite frankly, I struggle with this personally. Why does something like this have to be demonic? It seems more likely that it's just too challenging for certain people's minds, so they search for an excuse, and unfortunately within a religious context sometimes they will settle for a demonic presence. And I must admit that I get quite frustrated when something occurs that would seem to be direct evidence of what many of us believe or want to believe, and the very fact that evidence has arrived is not proof of God, it's not proof of a loving force or an eternal life. It's apparently just evidence of demons messing with us. It seems like it can only be benevolent if there's no evidence for it, which is, in my opinion, kind of ridiculous. I mean, how do we get past this quite closed-minded position on spiritual experiences? Because it would seem to me that it's an absolute necessity for us to let go of these rather archaic ways of seeing life after death and the evidence that's being presented for it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how we get by it. I think it's up to each person to open up their minds. But it's interesting you brought up Erica, because I recently emailed her to ask her, well, did your family, because she was worried by coming forward that her family was going to react, as you said, and I asked her. And she said, no, everybody was really positive about it. So maybe as a result of her going through this, it's actually changed some of the perceptions of her family. What was awesome about that scene, though, was that, it was unfolding in real time, that Atlas was this 5-year-old gorgeous little boy. And we see Jim Tucker from University of Virginia going there and speaking to Atlas and to his mom, and actually doing these photo recognition tests to see if Atlas could remember some of these things from the previous life. So he'd be shown 2 pictures that were very similar and asked to pick out which one was the correct one. Pictures of his previous parents, of his previous house, his previous, where he used to go to the playground and all these things. And he picked all of them accurately without any thought about it. He just right away recognized which one was the correct one. So it's just a fun thing to see on the screen, because he's so authentic.
Yeah, no, he is. Exactly. I mean, it's very believable. Very. And,
he's only a little kid. It's not like with the photographs, there's any way he could have been prepared to do that or anything. I mean, Erica didn't know what Jim Tucker was going to bring to her house. When they were filming it was all done very carefully. So yeah, it was just a nice way to open up the episode. And then it gets into the 2 cases from my book, Ryan Hammonds and James Leininger. And we visit them as older people, and which is really also really interesting to see, talk about the cases, but also to see them as older and to see how this has what this is, how this has affected them and what they're thinking about now and things like that.
Now, I want to move on to one of your more recent endeavors, but before we wrap this part up, let me just once again encourage all of those listening to go ahead and read Leslie's book, Surviving Death. A link to purchase the book can be found in the description box below. And of course, if you're able to check out the Netflix series Surviving Death as well, then I would recommend you do so. But I must say that after both reading the book and watching the Netflix series, the level of investigative work, evidence presented, and just simply the level of detail that is provided is far more extensive within the book. And so if you want a fully comprehensive understanding of this investigation, then I would recommend the book simply due to the fact that it has allowed for a greater level of detail, which, you know, to be fair, is pretty much always the case when it comes to media that's been adapted from a book. The book tends to be more detailed, and that's certainly the case here. So once again, links will be in the description box below. Now, quite recently, Robert Bigelow, CEO of Bigelow Aerospace, original funder of the Advanced Aerospace Weapons Systems Applications Program, known as AWSAP, previous owner of the infamous Skinwalker Ranch, and the man behind the National Institute of Discovery Science, better known as NIDS, has set up a new institute, this time focusing completely on the ideas of expanded states of human consciousness and whether or not it survives the experience of physical death. Essentially, he is setting up an institute in order to prove the existence of life after death. He's called it the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies, or BICS for short. And amongst others, you're listed on the website under the Judges and Directors section. Just to clarify, are you a director at BICS or are you a judge for the competition that Bigelow's announced?
I'm a judge. I mean, I'm actually a board member. So what's listed on the website are the board members and the judges, basically.
Right.
And there are five judges, and then there's one additional board member, and then there's Robert Bigelow and Colm Kelleher, who was the person who's worked with Robert for years and years. He worked with him at throughout the time of NIDS. And so Colm is not mentioned yet on the website, but he's a sort of executive director type. He's the guy that's doing all the work on the ground. Right now, there are applications pouring in from all over the world for this contest that they've announced. If you want me to talk about that, I can, what this judging is all about. But what it is that Robert Bigelow is putting up almost $1 million to give awards for essays in answer to the question, what is the best evidence for the survival of consciousness after physical death or bodily death? And he's invited people to submit these essays, up to 25,000 words, addressing that question. And I don't think the goal is necessarily to prove it. I mean, that's a strong word. You mentioned the word proof, but he's hoping to get material information beyond a reasonable doubt, is the way he wrote it on the website. You know, as close to proof as is possible.
Right.
And there's a wide range of criteria for people who might want to participate. It's not just limited to scientists, academics, but there are some criteria, but he's casting a very wide net as to who can actually apply to be part of this. And that's all the information for that is on the website. If you just go to BICS, B-I-C-S, type in BICS and Bigelow, you'll get to the website. Yeah, and so I'm one of five judges who are going to be reading all these essays, which are due August 1st, I believe. They're due August 1st. The application process goes on until February 28th. So if anybody listening wants to check it out, and there's still time to apply to submit an essay. And it's just really, really, to me, fascinating that I'm going to get to read these incredible essays and because the prizes are so large, first prize is $500,000, $500,000. Second prize is $300,000, and third prize is $150,000.
So, yeah, he's not messing around.
No, I mean, because there is so much at stake for, you know, there's such a high prize, I think that it's attracting a lot of attention. And that's why he's doing this. He wants this to become a more mainstream occupation. He wants this research to become accepted and to become known and to become of interest to people and to draw people out of the woodwork who may have been privately really interested or working on this for years and years, but it's not really accepted by their universities or by their culture. And he wants to change the whole paradigm of how people look at the research into survival.
Yeah.
And that's really the motivation for this. And so having a prize at that level is what it takes to make this thing happen. And the motivation is really to just make it better known and stimulate people to do more research. And because he wants to find these answers, personally, he does. He has the resources to put into this. And so this is how he's going about making this happen.
Can you talk us through how you got involved in this? Did he approach you specifically because of your investigations in this area of interest? Did you reach out to him? What was the process?
He approached me after reading my book.
I thought so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was really, really, you know, really liked the book. It really touched him. It inspired him. And he lost his wife a year ago. So, we just started to have conversations around all of some of the things I'd written about. And he had been interested in starting up this institute. So he asked me if I would participate. That's basically how it happened. And then asked me if I would become a judge. And I said, of course.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can imagine you were quite happy to take that on.
Absolutely. I'm thrilled. It's just going to be an incredible journey and an adventure. We don't know what's going to come of it. We don't know what's going to come in. But I'm sure there's going to be some fascinating work. And the point of it is to make it all public.
Yeah.
The point of this is to get it out into the world. And so there's no holding back any of it. I think a lot more than the three winning essays are going to be made public as well. I mean, there are going to probably be a lot of others that are excellent. And it's just a way. Yeah. So it's all going to be available for everybody to read. And one of the criteria is that the people contributing have to be willing to do media interviews, have to be willing to be public about it, because that's why we're doing it. So we'll see what happens.
Now, obviously it's this competition right now, but is there anything else that we can expect from BIX? I mean, obviously the mission statement is to find the best evidence for survival of the physical experience that we call death. But is there any sort of other tangible plan, any kind of like specific programs or scientific endeavors that are like the focal point of this institute right now? Or is it quite simply like the competition is the main thing?
I mean, that's the main thing for right now, but there's definitely, that's not going to be the end. I mean, there are definitely going to be other projects, other investigations. You know, there's going to be possibly research that the organization will promote or sponsor. I mean, it's sort of unknown right now, but I know that Robert Bigelow wants to take on other projects after this. This is not the end all deal. This is just the initial thing to launch this.
Just the precursor.
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of what happens next will come out of what we learn from going through this process of reviewing these essays and what comes out of all of that. I think it will naturally, organically kind of evolve, but there will definitely be more to come. That's for sure. I just don't think it's that clear yet what it's going to be.
Right. Now, although BIX is focusing on the concept of an afterlife, it's no secret that Robert Bigelow has not only been a major proponent of UFO, UAP disclosure, but has poured millions into the endeavor. Do you personally see a connection between the UFO, UAP phenomena and the question of life after death and expanded states of consciousness? Are these fields of study interlinked, in your opinion?
I think they're definitely interlinked. And I can't say that I feel qualified to really talk about how or, you know, really having an understanding of that at this point. But I know that, I mean, certainly the phenomenon of UFOs and, you know, people who witness UFOs, there are things that happen within consciousness, within their own consciousness, that are impacted by those sightings. So there's some kind of a link. I mean, that's a very simplistic way of describing it, but there's no doubt that there's a link and that some people have talked about encounters with deceased people when they're having UFO encounters or UFO experiences. So, I mean, they're certainly interconnected as far as I see it. But, you know, my focus as a reporter is to sort of stay with the hardcore reporting that I hope to keep doing for the New York Times, which just doesn't go there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that that's not a fascinating, component. And I think you know, I think, or the way Robert Bigelow has described it, and I sort of, this is the way I've always described it too, is that there are two human questions that are the biggest questions we have. One of them is, are we alone in the universe? And the other one is, what happens after we die?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, he's put a lot of time and energy into, are we alone in the universe? And he now feels that this is the most important question that he wants to focus on. I'm not sure he's so focused on linking them, but he's focused on that question of consciousness after we die. And that's, and who knows where that's going to go? Maybe the next phase will be finding a way to connect the two more. I mean, there are people working on that already, but I'm fascinated by that, but I can't say that I know much about it or really have a very deep understanding of what that's about, that link, but I'm sure it's there.
If we could somehow prove the existence of an afterlife, indefatigably make it a case of absolute fact that it is recognized by the wider scientific community, what kind of impact do you believe this would have on the world, especially within the realms of science, wherein so far an intuitive sense of there being more to this life is, you know, understandably within the scientific way, it's brushed away as wishful thinking with no basis in the scientific method. If we could somehow prove an afterlife exists, what do you just personally think that would do for humanity?
Wow, that's such a profound question, Jay. You know, I've thought about it a little, but I should think about it more. But I think
I put you on the spot a bit with a very big question, but don't worry too much.
That's okay. No, it would certainly, I think, of course, it would take away the fear of death to some extent. I think it would unify people more. You wouldn't have, maybe it would minimize some of the conflict that exists between different religious belief systems if we sort of all agreed and we had knowledge, well, this is actually what happens, because a lot of religions are built around belief systems about the afterlife that can, and they might conflict with each other. So, you know, there could be kind of a more harmonious view of what the nature of consciousness is and what the spiritual life is all about. And maybe it would, people would be treat each other better somehow if they knew that, you know, after this physical life, they were going to go on and they had a soul and they were going to be held accountable or whatever might happen after you die. I think it would elevate people's sense of who they are and of reality in a positive way. I mean, it's a pretty simplistic answer to your question, but it feels to me like it would be a positive thing for people to know that, if indeed it was ever possible to prove it. I also feel like there are maybe some things that we're not supposed to know, that we're not supposed to know
100%, right.
You know,
yeah.
And this might be one of them. There's a mystery is a good thing also, you know, it's you don't want to necessarily know everything. So maybe we're not gonna know this.
Well, we dare not solve all the problems, because then there'll be nothing to do.
I mean, I think it's gonna be easy. It's easier to prove the reality of UFOs than it is.
Yeah, no, yeah, for sure.
Afterlife. So whether we'll ever get there, I don't know, but I can only imagine that it would be a positive thing and you know, I think it's the kind of thing where everybody has to come to it in their own way, through their own belief systems, their own frame of reference. Certain things are gonna resonate more with some people than with others in terms of what to them constitutes evidence for this reality, what kind of experiences they've had. It's very personal and individual. And so everybody just has to go on their own journey with it. And I hope that my book, and I hope that the series on Netflix will help just open up doors for people and help provoke them and inspire them to want to learn more and maybe to take their own experiences more seriously and to see them in a different light. You know, so many people have written me on Facebook, Jay, and contacted me about their own experiences that they have felt before they couldn't really talk to anybody about, you know, involving after-death communications or visions or dreams or near-death experiences or whatever it might be. And I think if doing this work publicly like I'm doing helps people, you know, even to be able to believe in their own experiences and to feel comfortable talking about them and to integrate them more into their own reality and their own life experience, that to me is a really positive thing, even if that's all that happens.
That's a brilliant answer. Leslie, it has been a pleasure to speak with you once again. Honestly, last time I had you on, I was basically interrogating you and Ralph Blumenthal over your work with the New York Times regarding the UAP issue. And so it's been genuinely really nice to have a change of pace in comparison to that and just have this conversation. So yeah, thank you so much for you know, taking the time to speak with me on this.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Jay.
But one thing as well, before I let you go, I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to ask you, when it comes to the coverage of the UAP issue within mainstream media and the necessity for it to be taken seriously, which has most definitely been bolstered by the serious and sensible reporting by yourself and Ralph, I have to ask, have you got anything up your journalistic sleeve? Any new articles on the horizon?
I can't really say. We're always just so discreet about commenting about it. But just to say that we are always looking for the next story for the New York Times. And, you know, I don't think people realize how hard it is to get something at the level of rigor. And, you know, just what the high standard that the Times requires means that there aren't that many stories that will work for reporting in the New York Times. So, hey, if anybody out there has a story or has seen something or has information that we could bring to the New York Times, we're just always looking and we're always talking to our sources and following what's going on. But it's just not that often that something comes around. So especially things that have to do with government and military, the UAP task force, all of that.
Yeah.
We want to continue to cover that when we can get enough information to make that happen.
There we go. Any intelligent spooks listening right now, please contact Leslie and let's get the ball rolling. But no, seriously.
Yeah, come on the record if you're going
to. Yeah. No, seriously though, thank you so much, Leslie. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Thanks again for having me, Jay.